So great to be joined with all of you this morning. Well, we're going to have an awesome summer as we begin a new study together. And I got a lot to read to you, the whole of first chapter of Daniel. So let's jump in. Would you take, it's in your bulletins, it'll be on the side screens. And if you would follow along as I read, all right? During the third year of King Jehoiakim's reign in Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. So he conquers Jerusalem. The Lord gave him victory over King Jehoiakim of Judah and permitted him to take some of the sacred objects from the temple of God. Now that confuses me about God, I got to tell you. So Nebuchadnezzar took them back to the land of Babylonia and placed them in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, his chief of staff, to bring to the palace some of the young men of Judah's royal family and other noble families who had been brought to Babylon as captives. The instructions were to select only those who are strong, healthy, and good-looking young men, he said. Make sure they are well-versed in every branch of learning, that they are gifted with knowledge, that they have good judgment, and are suited to serve in the royal palace. Train these young men in the language and literature of Babylon. The king assigned them a daily ration of food and wine from his own kitchens. They were to be trained for 3 years, and then they would enter the royal service. Daniel and his three friends were four of the young men chosen, all from the tribe of Judah. The chief of staff gives them new names now. He gives them these Babylonian names. Daniel was called Belteshazzar. Hananiah was called Shadrach. Mishael was called Meshach. And Azariah was called Abednego. But Daniel was determined not to defile himself by eating the food and wine given to them by the king. He asked the chief of staff for permission not to eat these unacceptable foods. Now God had given the chief of staff both respect and affection for Daniel, but he responded and said, "I am afraid of my lord the king, who has ordered that you eat this food and this drink this wine. If you become pale and thin compared to the other youths your age, I am afraid the king will have me beheaded." Daniel then spoke with the attendant who had been appointed by the chief of staff to look after Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. "Please test us. Just do this for 10 days and put us on a diet of vegetables and waters," Daniel said. "At the end of those 10 days, check us out. See how we look compared to the other young men who are eating the king's food. Then you can make your decision in light of what you see." The attendant agreed to Daniel's suggestion, and they were tested then with this food for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, Daniel and his three friends looked healthier and better nourished than the young men. All of you Vegemites, you love these scriptures. Got to have a burger once in a while. Then the young men who had been eating the food assigned by the king. So after that, the attendant fed them only vegetables instead of the food and wine that was provided for the others. God gave these four young men an unusual aptitude for understanding every aspect of literature and wisdom, and he gave Daniel a special ability to interpret the meanings of visions and dreams. When the training period ordered by the king was completed, the chief of staff brought all the young men to King Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked to them, and no one impressed him as much as Daniel and the three. So they entered the royal service. Whenever the king consulted them in any matter requiring wisdom and balanced judgment, he found them 10 times more capable than any of his magicians, his enchanters, his psychics in his entire kingdom. Daniel remained in the royal service until the first year of the reign of King Cyrus. And that's the whole of the first chapter of the book of Daniel. Now, Daniel is an understatement to say that he is a remarkable human being. But in all of that that makes him so remarkable, the one thing that Daniel never thought or never planned on was that he would end up in Babylon. Now, the writer tells us that from Judah, his hometown, he is one of the brightest and the best in all of Israel. And the writer helps kind of broaden or paint a bigger picture of who Daniel was in verses 3 and 4. He's from a family of high social status and all that that would have afforded him. He is physically flawless. He is strikingly handsome. You're thinking of me right now. I know you are. He is extremely intelligent. He has outstanding people skills, and he is deeply devoted to God. And with those things come all the dreams that any young man would have. Now, in Judah, his future was absolutely predictable. The whole world was his. Success is around every corner. He's going to marry whoever he wants, live wherever he wants. He's going to occupy a place of prominence in the public arena, and he's going to have a life of greatness. He will do great things for God. His life is poised. The rocket is shooting upwards and to the right. He is poised for the very top. But life didn't turn out quite as he planned. And when we read those very first verses, verses 1 and 2, you simply cannot, unless you read and understand history, you cannot understand the degree of suffering, pain, disappointment, and heartache that are in those verses. Now, God had made a promise to a man long before whose name was Abraham. And he said, Abraham, I'm gonna with you, we're gonna build a new community, the likes of which the world has never seen. And Abraham, through you and that community, I'm gonna bless the whole world. I'll be at work in you and through you. You will be my people and I will be your God. And that hope-filled promise sustained Israel century after century after century. And that promised community, they had some remarkable highs, but they also had some remarkable lows, which made them wonder, where's the promise? Where's God? They lived for four centuries as slaves in Egypt. They wandered for four decades aimlessly in the desert. Under the leadership of Solomon and then his son David, they will reach what is known as the high point, the golden era. The temple will be built, but after that will come this long, slow, and dark decline. The kingdom, Israel, is divided into two. The southern kingdom, which was Israel, and it will be absolutely destroyed. The temple will be taken over. And all that will be left is the northern kingdom, which is Judah. And Nebuchadnezzar and his armies will come into Judah when Daniel is but a young man. And with very little effort, they will destroy. And all of God's dream seems to be wiped out. The ups are gone, and it is all downhill from here. The temple is but a memory. The sacred contents of the temple are now taken and preserved, of all things, in the temple of a false pagan god. Daniel will come to adulthood, living in a foreign land and giving the very best years of his life to an alien king. He's lost his home. He's lost his culture. He's lost every cherished relationship. He's got to learn to speak a new language. He'd never go home. He will live and die in a place that he has never chosen, and he will even lose his name. You know, one thing I've read Daniel, I probably read it 10 times just in preparation for our summer together. And I noticed there's not one single complaint in the entire book of Daniel. In the midst of all the loss that is there, even his name. Now, Daniel and his three friends, their given Hebrew names all had reference to God. In Hebrew, if you have El or Yah, like the name Elohim for God or Yahweh, all of their names contained, every time you said their name, their names were a promise. It was a reminder that they belonged to God. In fact, Daniel, any of you who are named Daniel, the L on the end of that, Daniel's name meant the Lord is judge, that God is the one who is setting things right. But the problem is, it's all wrong. Where is God? Where is his promise? Daniel is no longer, God is setting things wrong, right. Where is God and his promise to be their God? What do you do when you end up in Babylon? Because friend, one day you will. What do you do when life doesn't turn out quite like you planned? Babylon is when you get cut off from the life that you were planning on. You may never get home. And worst of all, where's God? Does he know? Does he care? And how could he let this happen? What do you do when you find yourself in Babylon like Daniel? Now, there's a whole field of study on human beings, and the field is called, it's a study on resiliency. And researchers have studied POWs from the Korean War, from Vietnam. In fact, there was a study done on, some of you will remember, in I think it was 1992 under President Carter, that we had 52 hostages that were held in Iran for 14 months. And as they have studied people who have experienced great trauma and crisis, the studies show that there are some people who are defeated easily by such events. But they also show that there are some people who don't just survive trauma, they actually enlarge their capacity to handle problems, and they are strengthened in their ability to persist, to endure, to be tenacious, and even to be creative. They don't just survive the stuff of life. They actually thrive through the trauma, and researchers call them resilient. It's the ability to thrive when things are the most difficult. Daniel is one of the most, and I use this word because I believe it has to be used. He is one of the most spiritually resilient people in all of the Bible, in all of history. That's why his life is so worth the study, because we find, we encounter the God who helps him not just survive, but thrive. So the question this first weekend is, what is it that marks someone who is growing in spiritual resiliency? So I got three little things to tell you, and then we'll be done. All right, number one, spiritually resilient people make way back here a deepest decision that they will not dishonor their deepest values. They refuse to live as passive victims of circumstances that they can come to believe are beyond their control. They make this resolve, this is their decision, no matter what, no matter what, I will trust and honor God. That's the decision. Now, the turning point in the whole book of Daniel is in verse 8. The book hinges right there. Because up to verse 8, it is all about the Babylonians and Nebuchadnezzar. They are making all the calls. They are in the driver's seat. They are determining everything. And it would have been easy for Daniel to have just thought, you know, I'm just sort of a passive victim of forces that are way bigger than me. But from verse 8 on, it shifts. Now in verse 7, the chief of staff determined, he decided, he is choosing, and he's going to not only determine their food, but he's going to give them new names. But then in verse 8, Daniel will resolve, he will decide, he will determine. Now this is important because the same verb that is used in verse 7 for this resolve or determination by Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon is now the same verb used in verse 8 by Daniel. Daniel, the captive, is going to make a decision. He will resolve something. He goes to the dean of the school and says, listen, can I talk to you about the cafeteria menu? Now, we are not told why this food would have been a violation for Daniel. And I think because it wouldn't have been important. Maybe it was food offered to idols. We don't know. But what is clear is that Daniel draws a line and takes a stand. You simply cannot understand the kind of courage that was required in this decision that he made. Nebuchadnezzar was not the kind of leader who was known for his tenderness. He ruled by cruelty and intimidation. He never cut anybody any slack. In fact, leaders have various styles, and some leaders have a very prominent hands-on kind of leadership style. And then there are other leaders who have a very prominent hands-off. They're much looser in their management style. Well, Nebuchadnezzar had a heads-off management style. But in the midst of all of that, Daniel will determine something. He will do it in Babylon, right in front of Nebuchadnezzar. He remembers his name. He remembers that he is not some helpless pawn of circumstances that are way beyond his control. He decides. Spiritually resilient people are just that way. They will honor and trust God no matter what. And they will not accept any excuse that they live in forces that are too powerful for them. So he goes to the dean of the school, makes this food request, and his response is no can do. Impossible. Because what will happen is you will end up weak and I will end up dead because you ended up weak. So Daniel, now notice his tenacity. Notice his persistence. Daniel goes to the next guy down on the org chart and he just says, look, I'm not asking for a permanent change in the cafeteria food. I'm just asking, let's do a 10-day experiment. Because you got to love his skill. He just says, look, this will win for you. I mean, 10 days won't hurt us. And if it all works, the king will think amazing call. So just give me 10 days. And the guy says, yeah, we can do that. So they all put on the veggie platter, and Daniel will graduate as a valedictorian of his class. When it looked like everything was over, when it looked like everything was lost, Daniel decided. He resolved that God will be supremely honored even in Babylon. Now, nobody ever plans to go to Babylon. Nobody. The husband, the wife, who just thought they could flirt with sexual lines without, they never planned, they never intended for that to end up in Babylon. The business person who just says, you know, there's a shortcut to the top. I'm just going to cross some ethical boundaries. They never planned for a business to blow up and for Babylon to occur. So many never planned on things that have happened. And somebody here today, maybe there's somebody, you see yourself as a helpless victim and that there's nothing you can do. And sort of your deal is, you know, circumstances have determined my destiny. Daniel would shout to you today, friend, remember your name. And with the help of God, you resolve in your heart, I will not lay down. I will not give in. I will not bow down. It is that spirit, that decision that is required for spiritual resiliency. Let me tell you a little secret. The secret is this. We all live in Babylon. All of us. We live in a world that will intimidate you into choosing far less than God's best for you. In fact, to those parents today, man, just diligently pray for your kids. Because this world will long to shape them and form them so that they become less than all that God has intended for them. You must decide, because this is your life. This is your one and only life. So Daniel and the guys will be told, listen, you either bow to the king or you will burn. And because of the decision that they had made way back here, they said, keep the ovens really hot because we ain't bowing down. Daniel, listen, we're going to, don't you pray one more time to your God or else we're going to throw you to the lions. Keep them real hungry. And tomorrow morning early, be looking in my directions because the windows will be wide open. I will be praying to my God. If Daniel and his friends had not decided way, way back here and drawn a line in the sand where their deepest allegiance would be, they would have never had the courage to face the furnace nor the lions. So I want to ask you, resolve again, decide. Maybe it's for a first time. Maybe you must decide again. I will honor and trust God no matter what. Amen? Two more things. Spiritually resilient people are committed to the development of like-minded spiritual people who will be friends in their lives. Daniel has these three friends. These three friends have Daniel. They're going to go to school together. They're going to pray together. They're going to encourage each other together. They're going to study together. They'll decide together. They'll resist together. They will face the fire together. And one day they will rule together. This little band of friends will actually change the course of a nation. When you live in Babylon, you will not survive and you will certainly not thrive outside of community. One researcher in this area of resiliency, I read this story many years ago and it's one of my favorites, but he writes about a guy who, his Vice Admiral James Stockdale. And the reason that they looked at his life, they say that he maybe suffered more than any other POW in the Vietnam conflict. 2,714 days he was held in captivity. Brutal, by the way, captivity. And on one occasion, the story is told by him and others that he was naked, his hands were shackled behind him and his feet, and he was beaten mercilessly. And then he was taken out into the hot Vietnamese sun and just left there. And for 3 days, every time, I mean, he tells the story that he really just wanted to die. He just wanted to be dead. But if he would even fall asleep, or they would come and beat him so that he couldn't even sleep, just left in all this. And he tells the story how in the midst of that, he heard a snapping of a towel or like a blanket, which was a code that the POWs had devised. And they had letters that they knew, they were symbols for words that they wanted to communicate with each other. And here were the letters that were snapped out to Vice Admiral James Stockdale. They were G, B, Y, J, and S. God bless you, James Stockdale. For those POWs, the briefest experience of community and connection was a matter of life and death for them. Their devotion and their ingenuity to make any kind of human contact possible in the midst of unbelievable obstacles, to me, defies belief. They couldn't talk, so they just had ways to send messages by snoring, by belching, by blowing, and by snapping towels and shaking blankets. Deep friendships, and look, we all know this, they don't come to us by accident. You got to contend for them. You got to fight for them. I was with somebody recently who is in some really deep weeds. And it's not even because of their own misconduct. It's just they happen to be in Babylon right now. So I asked them, just a series of questions. I just wanted to, for them to have a chance to just pour their heart out. And at the end I said, look, who's praying for you? Who's walking with you? Who's encouraging you? Who's holding your feet to trust God and to honor Him? And their response to me was, no one. Nobody. And I said, wait, before we go any farther. And they said, look, Mark, I've tried that. I've tried a couple of life groups. And I just said, look, try again. Reach again. Pray again. Go again. Keep trying again. Because all of us need a few someones in our life who will take out the towel and snap, God bless you, Mark Pickerel. Your life matters more than you would ever know. We all need to hear the code. Spiritually resilient people contend to live in vibrant, Christ-centered community. Alex, would you come as we conclude on this third point this morning? Spiritually resilient people never lose sight that their life and their suffering has meaning and purpose in the eyes of God. People give up not so much when suffering grows more intense, but when they believe that their pain has no purpose. I was reflecting as we were coming to this weekend. And I don't know why this popped into my head, but I think I can recall 5 times in the last 40-some years that I was strangely honored, and I think that's appropriate, that there was a suicide in a family. And if I can remember, about 5 times, the family, for whatever reason, I didn't ask, wanted me to read a suicide letter or note that was left. And it was a strange thing to read somebody's final words, but I felt so deeply honored, and it was important to them that I would read that, so it was important that I do that. And as I held that letter, but as I remember those five times, what I recall is that those notes did not primarily focus on failing health, finances, or a relational rejection. But in each letter, they just said, I could find no reason for me to keep living. See, Daniel will make a discovery in Babylon that he would never have made in Israel, and it is this. He discovered that somebody is always at work. Because the chief character in the book of Daniel, it is not Daniel. It is not his three friends. It is not Nebuchadnezzar, and it is not Babylon. It is God. Three times in this first chapter, in verse 17, in verse 9, and in verse 2, it's God. The writer of this story is convinced that God is at work even in the defeat of Judah and even in the destruction of the temple. God never fell asleep at the wheel, but he's at work in Babylon, the place of greatest suffering. So whatever you suffer, God is at work. Nobody plans to end up in Babylon, a seemingly God-forsaken place. But God was with Daniel, and in this story, he will rise to the highest level of leadership in that nation because God is at work. Whatever Babylon you find yourself in, God is up to something in Babylon. What a God we serve. Let's sing together, Alex.